So yeah, after that quick break, we're back and we're gonna start.
Yeah, quick break.
Yeah, it was 1 week. So yeah, we're gonna dissect
time travel.
The first book in the first movie of the series, the Philosopher's Stone or the Sorcerer's Stone.
Falafel Stone for the Indians.
What?
Oh, wow.
Letters.
You're fired. That was quick. That was quick.
Jesus.
You have anything else you'd like to offend people with?
Let's see.
Your mama's so,
women.
Your mama's so fat joke?
Nah, let's see. How about a Japanese one?
Wow. Oh, God, why? So back to Harry Potter. Yeah,
thank you.
We're going to start with the first book, 1997. That's where it came out.
Holy shit.
In the UK, it came out in 1997. We didn't get it until 1998.
Because we get everything late.
Time was different across the pound.
It was a new property, and they weren't sure whether it was going to sell well, because that's the reason why they turned it into the Sorcerer's Stone.
Yeah.
It's the first story in the Harry Potter
because
franchise.
Because we don't like philosophy here in America.
And it's or probably, to a certain extent, the most innocent
of the books?
Series, well, yeah. While also at the same time, sort of the more...
Magical, really. If you think
I want to say darker.
Really?
Especially toward... It's one of those things where, like, Harry's a character, is all naive, he's brought to this magical world.
Yeah.
And then the forces of darkness sort of collide, like, sort of work against him.
Oh.
Hail Cobra.
But he's like, it's like, with the older Harry is sort of a more jaded, a more cynical figure.
Yeah.
Not so much, but a more hardened figure.
But when he was
fresh...
Fresh face and
yeah,
so...
Yeah, naive, innocent, and, like, the darkness, like, if he forced the face...
So he's, maybe he's saying not dark, not darkest, but more dangerous.
Yeah,
because he's still young.
He's so vulnerable.
So this
point.
Is the, this is the like, beginning of his innocence being taken away.
It's like dropping a young like doe in the middle of a forest that they have no idea what's going on.
It's like staying with your uncle.
I did that once.
I don't know about your uncle, but
Drunkle Ted, no.
Drunkle.
You know, every day. He always had the pocket. Didn't actually have a pocket in there.
Oh God!
And he starts. What's all this?
Dead air.
Yeah.
So anyway, so it's the story of the first book is essentially that it sort of opens up with sort of I guess the aftermath. This is the event that ended sort of. The story of Perry's family, and him being dropped on the Jersey's doorstep, and then
the origin story.
Did you call him Perry?
No,
Harry.
I said Harry.
Oh, okay, sorry,
Harry Perry.
So we see an insight into his life with the Dursleys and more of their general abuse, neglect him as a young lad.
He made him live under the stairs.
And the burgeoning beginnings of his magical power, which they sort of hint towards, like one day he ends
he
up.
He made his aunt blow up.
Well, that was in the third book. Oops. But like in the first book, they talk about how he was being chased by his cousin and his gang, but he ended up on the roof.
Yeah.
I never like understood that. Crawling.
How did this happen?
And then they make a point in the book as well about like Harry, they can never give him a haircut because every time he gets his haircut, it always grows back to his normal shaggy look.
That changed fast.
That changed
the really movies.
Business cut.
Yeah, and and then we get the big moment where when he turns.
Wait, so then in the books, how long would his hair be?
He'd have that Fabio hair.
I guess the movie, the fourth book. That's,
he can manipulate it by
no. The fourth movie had the best, I guess,
hair power
interpretation of what I thought his haircut should be at that point.
Yeah.
But the earlier movies also, the first two movies did a good enough job of representing that Harry Potter hair.
You know, you think with all that magic they give him a better haircut.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Yeah, so, I'll die the haircut. I mean, we get the whole, his magical potential being recognized by Hogwarts, and then Dumbledore being very, very persistent in getting the message across to Harry and the Dursleys that he's a wizard.
I will have this.
You're a wizard, Harry.
To the point where he has, after they inundate the Dursley's house with letters, they essentially, Hagrid tracks Harry down.
On a deserted island.
On a deserted island, breaks into the house, attacks his cousin, and tells him, you're a wizard, Harry.
You're a wizard, Harry.
It's kind of like being a mutant. You just reveal that you have magical potential.
It's like that's actually interesting. Yeah. It's like
there is a lot of parallels to that because Charles Xavier and Magneto are pretty much Dumbledore and Voldy.
Not really.
Not entirely.
Charles,
other than,
Charles,
I see what you
other than the
bonus.
Broham.
I mean, not like that, but I'm talking
like,
about their views
on the two opposite sides, I guess.
Yeah, it's like a cross between.
But not an extreme.
It is like a cross between like X-Men mutants and like an episode of Maury.
You said Harry, like, he teleported to the roof or something. He can't have his hair cut because it's.
Well, it's one of the things for Harry. Actually, there's a parallel for mutation, but for majority of the magical children, they've grown up in the magical world, so it's not nothing new to them. It's like, okay, now I can use my
What about Hermione, then?
Hermione being a muggle-born is...
She's a special case where a mutant's parents actually... Whoops, wow. When a witch's parents actually...
Yeah, she's a muggle-born. Like, they make points about the story. Like, there's a lot of racial, like, genetic sort of going on in the background.
Okay.
Yeah, so he told he's a wizard. He's given a crash course into the magical world. We see Ollivanders. We get, like, a little hint. We see Gringotts, a little hint of, like, Quidditch, stuff like that.
Okay.
And then... So, like, Harry's forced to take him to the train station and then abandon him, sort of laughing home on the way. because the instructions say he needs to go to platform 9 3/4.
What?
There's no platform 9 3/4.
Yeah.
So they're like, well, he's stuck here, it's not our problem. But then he meets the Weasleys.
Parents of the year.
Meets the Weasleys. He becomes best friend with Ron.
Immediately.
Nice.
So, well, immediately.
How did he and Ron meet?
Like, Ron just showed, like,
what? Ginger vision.
What is with the ginger?
Jesus!
What ended up happening is that, Harry met the Weasley family, specifically Molly Weasley and Ginny and Ron as well. Like, he ran into them while they were going to Pat Magic.
Was this before he got Hedwig?
After Hedwig.
Hedwig.
Yeah,
Hedwig. I think Miss Weasley, like, recognized Hedwig and was like, no real kid's gonna happen.
Well, yeah, because he was sitting around the train station with a giant tray of luggage and he had an owl. So I was like, that was her first tip off that he's a wizard and he probably has no idea what he's doing. So she helps him in.
You're a wizard, Harry.
And then I guess, like, Ron was just looking for a place to sit and he sat down and there was Harry and they're like, I saw the friendship with Ron.
Wouldn't he mess up if he was just a kid with an owl?
Nice.
Security!
I'd rather have a falcon.
So, yeah, he goes to Hogwarts. The fact that he's Harry Potter starts to become
problematic
early on in the series because a lot of people are trying to reach from different ways to pull him in. Like, Draco Malfoy.
Harry.
Yeah, his first interaction with Harry is to tell him, you can hang out with us. You don't need to hang out with Ronald Weasley and being Gryffindor or anything.
Just like the new kid in school.
It's funny because, like, Harry could easily, like, the sorting hat, which is a big thing in the Harry Potter mythos, is the hat that puts people in either Gryffindor
decide your fate.
Slytherin or Hufflepuff.
Okay, I didn't actually know how that worked.
It takes based on your personality and your potential.
Yeah. So it's...
Or your
what's that test? Metrics?
Biometrics?
No, not biometrics. Personality and speech class.
I didn't take speech.
Like INJFT type stuff.
I guess.
That's what that sounds like.
You put the hat on your head and it sort of reads... It, like, who scans you?
Hufflepuff! Fuck!
The four houses were... we could have a definition in that first book of the four houses. Gryffindor being the bravest of the houses. They're the first people to sort of jump into a situation. Oh, we got this!
They're the front line.
Then you got Ravenclaw, which is pretty much predominantly made up of people, brainy people. Not necessarily smart people, but brainy people.
We're better than you.
Yeah.
Then Slytherin is made up of people with ambition. It's not. It's painted as a house of evil.
Did they just paint it? I just
simply because of what Voldemort sort of turned it into.
Yeah,
I don't think that's always played off. Like the cleverness is like kind of played off.
Not even cleverness. It's ambition.
Ambition, clever. Like it just always seems like it's like the Wile E. Coyote thing was just like he's smart, so he's the bad guy.
Well, simply because their house mascot was a serpent, so
automatically
it's evil.
Slytherins are all about ambition and to a certain lesser extent greed. They always want power.
Yeah.
And it's one of those houses where, like,
it's
if you're a cunning person,
too.
Yeah. And then Hufflepuff being, quote-unquote, the one they put everyone else.
Dang.
Hufflepuff sort of exemplifies steadfastness. Like, they may not be the most exciting people.
They're plucky.
But they're always the most dependable.
And they like chicken.
Okay.
Yeah. And the fatties go to the house
of
pancakes.
Is Hermione from Ravenclaw, then?
No. She was Gryffindor.
And the old
She's Gryffindor.
Really?
Well, they joke about why it's Hermione and Gryffindor, where she can easily have been a Ravenclaw.
Yeah, that's okay.
But, yeah, and then it's interesting, because Harry could have easily... Harry, like, Harry could have easily been in Slytherin house.
Oh, yeah. It actually originally was sorted him into Slytherin. He was
like the hat.
Oh, yeah. I did hear that.
Yeah, the hat. When they put the hat on his head, like, he'd already been hanging out with Ron. Mm-hmm. And so he'd already learned the basics of the houses. And Ron was like, I hope you're in Gryffindor. Like, my entire family's in Gryffindor. Yeah, Gryffindor is so awesome. Your parents are probably in Gryffindor.
Yeah.
And then, like, Malfoy immediately turned him off with Slytherin. He's like, I don't want to do that. I've heard nothing but bad things about Slytherin. He puts a hat in his head. He's like, not Slytherin, not Slytherin, not Slytherin. The hat asks him.
No whammy. Stop.
Is that really what you really want? He's like, Gryffindor. Okay. That's how we got sorted.
Yeah.
Well, since you don't want to be here so bad, we'll put you another one.
And I'm going pop.
And then from there we sort of established the normal, for the most part, the normal Harry Potter, I want to say, formula for how each book starts is that something slow happens in the beginning, sort of like the build, a story.
It usually starts at the house.
Then it starts off with the Dursleys. From there we get like Harry, like just like some character building and world building with Harry at school. Then usually around Christmas. Or some holiday, something big happens. We get to like a mini, I want to say, event.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then you have like another 6 months of them at school dealing with this mini, like the aftermath and what the threat of the book is. And then you have the big finale that usually always happens at the end of the year. And it's always when the teachers ignore what Harry tells them to do. One thing I actually really enjoy about Harry Potter is when Harry has an instinct, it's usually 95% of the time right.
Okay.
And people ignoring him.
Goddamn Scar.
And people ignoring him, and when he comes and gives warnings.
So he's Woody.
It's usually a problem.
Yeah. And he seems to, well, that's what I grasp from the movies. He always seems to, every year, learn a new skill. Some teacher takes him under his wing. I thought that was kind of cool.
But, well, it is, because, like, the school aspect of the franchise.
It's true.
Every year, he goes through a different level of school and gets different access to different levels of spells.
Yeah.
Like, the contrast of Hermione. We'll talk about that when we get to the second.
Well, I brought that up also because of the threat aspect.
But yeah, one is like
the threat becomes bigger each one.
Harry tends to learn spells based on necessity.
Okay.
And what level and his exposure. Well, Hermione, by most of the time Harry learns a spell, has already known it. It doesn't have any practical application for it.
It's like Hermione been so knowledge with no real reason to use it.
So, yeah, the crux of the first book is that the Sorcerer's Stone has been hidden at Hogwarts. And someone wants to steal it. And Harry immediately suspects Professor Snape.
Because he has a scowl.
Because of the bad blood between them.
Page 394. Okay. Sorry, I love that. That was the first.
And anyway. The bad blood between them. And then
it's just a rapper.
Oh, God.
But then the plot thickens when it's revealed that it's not so much Snape, but it's a return Voldemort. Attempting to use a stone to resurrect himself.
Pulling a retard and clinging to the back of Professor Quirrell's head.
On the back of his head, dead.
I really like the final act of that first book.
Because
it allowed all three characters of the main characters to shine.
Oh.
It was like Ron's
test.
Ron's ability to do strategy, Harry's skill for broom, which Quidditch, I'll talk about a bit later.
Blitzball.
And Hermione's sort of intelligence. The movie sort of
what was those called?
The trials.
Yeah, the trials. Yeah, it's not, I always like a good like group dynamic thing. Everyone's got that kind of skill.
I mean, it's never
everyone had something to add.
Right, everyone has something to offer.
It's never good when a member of your group seems useless.
Yeah,
you start to question why they're there.
As strong as your weakest link.
Yeah. I mean,
I could say something real mean. Not about any of you.
Yeah, I should pull with that.
Yeah, and then
I'm kidding.
And we end up with sort of Harry sort of facing his, I guess, eternal enemy for the first time and overcoming him.
Mm-hmm. I'm really gonna have to pick up the first book then.
I have all seven of them in three formats. But that was the first book.
Sorcerer's Stone. Okay.
Sorcerer's Stone. And then when was the first movie done? I wouldn't say 2000.
I think it was it's either 2000 or
01. That's when, like, they got the Christopher Columbus, the director, mm-hmm. was giving the early screenplay for the Philosopher's Stone, Sorcerer's Stone. And for his original plan, when he ran the book, he originally wanted it to be two movies.
And they were like, that's
not going to happen. Something I want to point out with the movies is that they suffer from having no end in sight, in that they streamline a lot of the Harry Potter franchise into a more, I guess, digestible movie. Mm-hmm. But in doing so, yeah. they cut out a lot of things and that nuances and that need to be there to further certain characters. So when they get to a believable point, mm-hmm. it makes sense.
Yeah, because in the movies, they're not necessarily as three-dimensional.
Well, the problem with the movie is that...
That's because they're young.
Well, yeah, but like...
The major problem with the movie is that none of the books were finished at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were still... When the first movie was made, they were still at book three. And book four was on its way.
Yeah.
And J.K. Rowling had given them the broad strokes, but she never revealed any details.
There's no way to plan.
It's just... She's really it's just a bit of, unfortunate yeah. that, you know, there couldn't be certain layers also added... You know, to give the characters more depth. You know, like, it's, yeah, like,
as far as arching the movies?
Yeah, like, yeah. There was nothing really wrong with, you know, the people that were casted. You know, they did great. Yeah, they did great with what they had.
The first movie would have come out. It came out in 2001. Mm-hmm. Then I was 12.
Jeez. Yeah.
So, at that point, someone who's been reading Harry Potter, like, the first couple of books... I was really excited to see these characters brought to life on screen. That's all I wanted to see. And,
of course.
And they hit that zeitgeist perfectly. I mean, the first books came out when I was 8, but the first movie came out when I was 12. So I was maybe a bit around Harry's age. And so when I first saw that movie and saw what they did for the Hogwarts on screen, it was amazing.
Yeah, it's like a lot of subtle things. It's like things flying in the background.
Well, yeah, with the first movie, it's usually like you never exactly see...
direction of the film.
Yeah, you it's like you never believe that this would be on film, and yeah. so when you see it, it's fantastic.
It's fantastical, yeah. That's what, and you really don't have an idea for how dark it's going to get later on.
Oh, yeah.
No point of reference, I guess. Yeah.
The second book in the series, The Chamber of Secrets, is probably next to the third one, one of my least favorite in the series.
I heard she had a problem with the second one, actually.
She nearly went crazy writing the fourth book.
Mm.
So, back to the second one, Chamber of Secrets, it deals primarily with, I guess, the book begins with Harry being cut off from the magical world.
Yeah.
Like, he already made these lasting friendships in the first book, but by the second one, he's heard from no one.
Oh, yeah, I remember that because Chamber of Secrets was actually the first movie I saw, and I found myself, like... already feeling like
when he's angry about it, he's just hurting, he's like, oh, no one, I met these friends, are they really friends? It turns out that the house elf Dobby, a really important character who for various reasons
remember
is
that
cut
name.
Out of the film franchise in various places,
yeah.
is responsible for doing so. And Dobby's words are, I'm doing this for your own good, you can't go back to Hogwarts, which brings in sort of the darker elements of the franchise. Because now,
Secrets.
With the first one, it was Voldemort doing something behind the scenes. This one, it appears that something is actively working against Harry. It might be an actual danger to him.
Right.
And from that, we get the... more insight to the magical world. In that, as a young wizard, Harry should not be allowed to use magic...
Outside of Hogwarts.
Yeah.
Ooh, which is another problem with the film franchise. And so, after being... expelled for it. Wasn't he expelled? No.
Suspended?
They sent him one warning.
They gave him a warning.
Was it because of the car incident?
No. He ruined the Dursley's party. And that's why he gets grounded.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Ron and his brother steal the Ford, I want to say Aglia, his family's flying car and bring Harry out.
Ah, man, that's, okay.
And then this is Harry's first taste of the true wizarding world. Like, he's been to Diagon Alley, sort of the marketplace for wizards,
mm-hmm.
but he's never been really seen, like, the wizarding world. And he finally got to see that when he went to the Weasley family. And he stayed with them. And despite Ron, his brother getting in trouble for stealing the car, his dad getting in trouble for having a flying car.
Yeah.
It was a chain of events.
It was
a good old finger wagging.
Yep.
We finally got that, Harry got that first sense of, I guess, family through the Weasley. Mm-hmm. They just took him in.
And discipline.
And then we get that first sort of hint at the Harry-Ginny relationship.
Yeah, because I heard, so you're a Harry. And Ginny was talking about some Harry Potter all summer. I was like, really?
Well, yeah, like, Ron being Ron, who just opens his mouth and just says whatever's on his mind,
he's like,
my sister's been talking about you all summer. She normally can't shut up about you, but when she walks in the room, she's like, and then then just walks away. Like, she's starstruck. So when they try to go back to Hogwarts in the second book, Dobby once again tries to stop Harry, stopping him and Ron from getting on the train and going to school. And so their bright idea of being impulsive young men is to steal the car and fly it halfway across Britain to Hogwarts.
Because that's the thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, sure, why not?
And for the most part, it works.
What could possibly go wrong?
For the most part, it works outside of a couple of muggles seeing the car and flying. Because one of the big things about the Harry Potter franchise is that wizards are an underground phenomenon.
Yeah, there's a wall, almost a...
There's a government agency specifically tasked with making sure that wizards aren't found out by
the urban legend.
Yeah.
Is that not that's not a muggle organization?
No, it's a human... No, it's a... No, it's a
yeah, I was going to say, that it's like okay, gotcha. Okay, cool.
Key humans know sense. About the wizards, but...
But it's just, yeah, you know...
Just keep it general outside.
Separate
it's
always been people.
Gotcha.
Not really.
And so they fly the car to Hogwarts, and the car ends up getting lost. They fly the car into the Whopping Willow, a giant crazy tree in the middle of the campus, which is a big part of the franchise, but it's one of her, I guess, layering into the story. Because the Willow
will play
a bigger part. Further down the line, but it's just kind of
a
thing.
She's a really good writer in the sense that she adds a little
bit
of
a lot of foreshadowing that you will check off.
Yeah, she's a master at foreshadowing.
Yeah. Her attention to detail is ridiculous.
But yeah, they crash the car, they get in trouble, but they still end up going to school and reuniting with their friends. And the big sort of, I guess, crux of this series is that at some point in Hogwarts' past, there was a monster that was let loose and killed people. And someone has found this monster and is using it to attack people again.
Yeah.
A basilisk. And what happens with a basilisk in this world is that if you see its eyes...
Like Medusa.
You turn to stone. No, actually,
or petrified.
No, you die. Petrification happens if you see its eyes through some sort of other...
Touch the surface.
Yeah. And so kids start dropping like flies. And when it's revealed that Harry...
And this is where it gets dark because children are actually dying.
Well, yeah. When they reveal that Harry can speak with snakes, everyone assumes that he's the one.
Parseltongue is the language of the snake.
Everyone assumes that he's the one who's responsible for this creature getting loose.
That's really interesting, you know. I do.
And it's one of the things where everyone's sort of scared of him, but sort of Ron and Hermione is like, well, Ron's like, you could be, you couldn't be. You're still my friend. And Hermione's like, I don't believe it. But so it's like one of those things where while everyone else sort of like pushes him away.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of get closer as a group.
So that's why... Okay, that makes sense.
And as the story progresses, we come to find out that the person who's been controlling the snake is sort of Ron's sister, Ginny. But she's not controlling it actively. She's been possessed by this magical diary, which is another bit of J.K. Rowling foreshadowing, which caught me by surprise. The diary is a small part of the series, but plays a bigger role later on.
Yeah.
That is very true.
One of the traits of the Harry Potter franchise is that every year at school, they get a new Defense of the Dark Arts teacher. The first one, they had Quirrell, who turned out to be the villain. In the second book, we got Gilderoy Lockhart, who's this sort of, I want to say, pompous windbag who thinks too highly of himself.
Yeah.
Do they circulate because they have to, or because that's just how they set up the curriculum?
They have to, because something bad happens to the job is quote unquote cursed. Something bad happens to that teacher every semester, and so
that's wild. Okay.
Yeah. So Gilderoy Lockhart, it's sort of when this monster gets loose in Hogwarts, it's such a bad thing that the school is on the verge of being closed, and because Hagrid was a in the last time the monster was loose, accused and, I guess, arrested for it the first time.
Yeah,
they arrested him the second time for this crime. He gets sent to Azkaban, which is another part of the Harry Potter mythos that gets further explored and used and for further stories.
That's the biggest hint ever.
I know.
And so Dumbledore, I guess, in this book, Lucius Malfoy, also introduced to Malfoy's father, Lucius Malfoy, who... is sort of, I want to say, sub-villain in this, in that he sort of orchestrates the majority of the events of the series.
Wow.
He's the one who gives Ginny the magic diary. He's the one who actively pursues to get Dumbledore kicked out of school.
Yep.
And with Dumbledore gone, the school is left completely undefended. And Harry, Hermione is a victim of this of monster in this book. So she's MIA for a good half the story.
Yeah.
And we also get the classic spider scene in the forest where I guess we're sort of revealed that Ron has... Ron's a sheepish young man. He's brave when he needs to be, but he's not, like Harry to jump into a situation.
He's more or less just stand back.
Do I have to?
Let everybody else do it.
Do I have to? He's like, do I have to? Okay.
Yeah. And, but he has only one major fear in life, and that's spiders. And he and Harry in an attempt to find out what this
Jovi
creature
is. Jovi and him have that in common.
Way to put him out there like that.
Thank you.
He'll be alright.
He and Harry in an attempt to find out this monster and stop it. Try to go to the Forbidden Forest, a big part of the franchise, and I guess they encounter this, I guess, Spider King, Aragog. They can really get killed, except they get saved by the flying car, which is still,
it's like, it makes about as much
it's
sense.
Like, it's like, it sounds like a subplot from Herbie.
the flying car. I'm just like, at this point, I'm just like, why not? Like, let's just throw in the James Bond invisible car while we're at it. It just seems like all this magic, and like, we can't even afford a GPS. Like,
one of the fun things about Harry Potter when they were exploring the magical aspect is that electronical devices do not work in Hogwarts.
Evidently.
Of course not.
Yeah. Because Hogwarts is such a magical place.
Well, it does
kind of
make sense. Because
it's such a magical place that it messes with electricity.
Right.
Machinery is kind of like the opposite of magic. You know, it's man-made. It's
simple things like watches will work. Like flash cameras will work.
Mechanical
things
analog things will work. Yeah.
But like a TV won't work.
Nah.
Stuff that's complex.
Stuff that pretty much works on its own almost.
Yep. Liquid soap doesn't work.
I feel rub really hard.
That just makes me think of cockroaches.
Chagall's face.
What?
Don't ask.
Next caller.
Avery knows.
So, Tom Marvolo Riddle.
Yeah,
and if you change it from I am Tom Marvolo Riddle, it all changes to I am Lord Voldemort.
Yeah, that blew my mind when I saw that. I was like, what?
Second book, awesome. Voldemort isn't a major threat, but he's still a presence in the book.
He's still a pain in the ass.
And we sort of get a more, I guess, examination of his past as Tom Riddle.
Mm-hmm. It's an awesome name.
This is more of like investigating the really darker aspects of Harry Potter. Was the third book.
Yeah. And then so what ends up happening is that Harry is forced to face off against a younger Voldemort who is using the life force of Ginny to, I guess, manifest himself in our world.
He's a memory or something?
Yeah,
he's a memory, but he's using, like, leeching the life off of her to kind of, like, make himself flesh.
Makes and while, Sephiroth.
While fighting that, he also has to deal with the giant basilisk.
Fuck that.
And without Dumbledore, it's one of the more, I guess, triumphant scenes in Harry Potter in that when the young Voldemort has a broken Harry, he's obviously going to win this fight.
Yeah.
Dumbledore's Phoenix Fox shows up, brings with him the Sorting Hat, which...
for some reason, has the Sword of Gryffindor inside of it.
The idea being that the sword is lost, and the hat is magically imbued in that... And Harry, in his time of need, drew the sword.
The sword only appears to people in a time of need that it deems worthy of holding.
Hmm. Okay. Sometimes it's a one-time deal. Okay.
And, in contrast to the movie, this is the Christopher Columbus was still directing this movie as well. Mm-hmm. He did the first two. And
I think he's still producing up until the third one. And even the later ones also,
This one was shot back to back with the first movie because all the actors were still young kids.
Were they shot back? The first one was shot back to back. Okay.
The first two were shot back to back.
And the last two
were shot
back to back.
Yes.
Everything else was just like, we'll take a year off, another year off.
Yeah, so like, when the aging hadn't crept up.
Right.
So like, at that point, all the actors were still like 12
when
they needed to be. And then, I want to say Cambridge Theaters is kind of unremarkable.
I mean, like, all right. And
it's not very memorable.
What? I mean, because like, at the time, it's like when you think about it, at the time, it was like billion-dollar grossing franchise movie. Just that first one. And it's like, so I guess it was just a big deal. I guess we look back at it now, it's like, oh, it's the first one. They're probably not going to make all the books into movies. And
I mean, the first one is kind of memorable, obviously.
The first one
is
that everyone who didn't read the book gets their first entry.
Kind of went
to
see.
But the second one is kind of like weak.
Yeah.
It's not the weakest, but it is weak.
And you're talking about movie wise, right?
Yes, right, right.
Yeah. I found myself actually bored with the Quidditch scene. And a few of it seemed like a long. I mean, I thought the Basilisk.
All of the Harry Potter movies are kind of long.
Yeah, they all.
No, I mean, because
they're trying to stuff in as much.
It was kind of dead.
The Quidditch sequence did kind of feel like, let's just throw in a montage. Well, like, in other movies, it's like
because it seemed in that scene
we need something
with him and Draco. It went on really long.
There were a few of the movies that were more atmospheric, and so there was a lull somewhere in the movie.
Yeah, I guess they just felt they needed to inject something more kinetic into that. Like, I mean, so.
But that's the problem with the traditional Harry Potter, I guess, formula, is that, like, in the books, action is sort of rare and hard to find.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's usually just a lot of storytelling and character development and just talking heads.
Right.
And exposition and learning about the world. Every once in a while, you'll get like a sort of fantastical scene of Quidditch.
And that's why it's a bit harder to watch. So, like, if they would have actually fully adapted, which would be impossible, but if they've adapted more of the book into the movies, for a lot of people, it'd be a little harder to watch.
In that case,
maybe a lot to digest at once.
Yeah.
You really want to babysit a group of kids watching a movie that long?
It's too long for them. It's like it would have to be it have to be television or something else. It could not be like a feature film.
That's probably why the
show. Yeah, it has to be a series.
That's probably why the second
they wouldn't be able to get the budget.
No, they would not. No, they wouldn't. I mean, unless they got
if they did remotely get us a budget close enough, they would cut major corners.
Yeah, we were talking about
even with the budget they had, they cut major corners.
Yeah,
exactly.
Like that's probably why the second Deathly Hallows will be the most exciting one because that's where everything comes to a head.
Yeah, stuff actually does happen.
So that's the second movie. Prisoner of Azkaban. It's just a continuation of the Harry Potter series.
Right.
It also brings in more tension between Harry and the Dursleys.
Yeah.
And sort of more Harry asserting his independence while simultaneously sort of giving more background to more of the events of the past of the Harry Potter franchise. Mm-hmm. We learn more about Harry's parents, their friendships.
Yes. Their stay at Hogwarts and what happened.
Yeah, like we're introduced to the Marauders, I guess the previous version of Fred and George at that school. A group of four, I want to say, delinquents who...
Mooney, Wormtail, Padfoot,
and
Prongs.
British people come up with the best names.
Yeah.
You know, right?
And also...
joke.
The third book is probably... It's better than the second one.
Yeah.
It's also bigger. This is also J.K.'s first experimentation with extending how big the books could be.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got...
Maybe because she had a little more clout at that time, or she could get away with
We were discussing about how like the books and how they grew with like the readers and the reader,
and then she had more story to tell.
Exactly, I felt like at that point it wasn't like
maybe she was starting to realize what she had, maybe, and so she could go bigger with it.
I don't know. The second one felt like it was a little short in my eyes.
The second one's like only slightly longer
than the first one, and the third one really got like in depth because you deal with Harry, his parents, his past, and then we meet Sirius. And
so you kind of get a crash course on his life. And
you kind of build like we kind of just jump right in.
Yeah.
This one builds sort of a foundation.
So the crux of the third book is that Harry Potter has he's come to Hogwarts and someone has escaped from Azkaban. Now Azkaban's a wizarding prison, which has had no one has ever escaped
because
they have a specific type of jailer known as Dementor, which are nearly impossible to defeat through normal means.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these sort of people, because of what Harry means to the world, he sort of put on like a weird sort of guard duty all the time,
house
like,
arrest, witness protection,
all that.
It's
like the president's kid.
Yeah. We're also getting more in depth to the Ministry of Magic, the government that works in the background of the Harry Potter world.
Yeah.
And through this, it becomes apparent that this escaped prisoner, Sirius Black, who we learn is quote-unquote responsible for Harry's the death of its parents,
yeah,
is hunting Harry down. Because he appears in places that Harry is. He attacks the school, where he attacks Harry's room. He does all. He just invades, I guess, his world.
Yeah.
And Harry, this is sort of where we're getting a more adult and more, I guess, mature Harry, because now he's angry. He's driven by the desire to see vengeance for what's happened to his family.
It's like that teenage angst, like, of him maturing, but he doesn't really know how to channel these feelings because he's just, like, lashing out at people.
Well, yeah.
He's fighting his friends. He's turning against people, but not, like, turning against them.
This is also the first time we sort of get... This is also one of the first times we get the divide between the friendship of the three characters.
Yeah.
This book, Hermione and Ron essentially stop being friends when it becomes apparent that Hermione's cat was Ron's rat. And Hermione, in sort of a bitch-like nature, isn't fazed by it. Like, she's like, oh, you shouldn't be mad, whatever.
Cats and mice. What do we expect? Like,
but she sort of glosses over the fact that this is Ron's pet.
Yeah.
It means a lot to him.
And he doesn't have a lot.
Yeah. And so what ends up happening is that their relationship is broken, so Harry's forced to take sides. Their friendship gets strained.
Because that's always fun.
Meanwhile, Harry's suffering from, I guess, the dark effect of the Dementors, the jailers of Azkaban, who've now become patrolling the school in search of Sirius Black.
Yeah.
For Dementors are basically walking black clouds of bad news. Any bad memory you've ever experienced in your life, anything terrible in your life, a Dementor will bring it out.
They look kind of like death.
Yeah, it's even like this.
Imagine death. Yeah, that's all I got.
They were trying to make it akin to, like, say, like, if you ever made, like, a mistake in your life and you just kind of start remembering all the other mistakes you've made, like, all at once.
Dementors are
it's all that at once.
Dementors are, I can't say walking because they don't walk. Dementors are a floating,
amorphous,
emotional, amorphous.
Not so much amorphous. They have a physical.
They do have a physical.
Right, they're a floating, emotional wound.
Are these people the quote unquote magical machine?
They're magical creatures.
Is it kind of like
there's some kind of creature, but good.
It's kind of like when people talk about.
It's one of the things where
you have to be powerful.
The wizarding world has learned to control them by giving them what they want. They feed on human souls. The wizarding world, with human souls and emotion.
That's
so the wizarding world feeds them through letting them guard the prison.
It's kind of like when people draw a picture of somebody in a bad mood and they have that black cloud over their head.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what a Dementor
is. Looking like death, and that's basically
Combat that, he starts taking classes with their new Dementor against the Dark
Remus.
Remus Lupin, one of my favorite characters.
Him a lot.
Mooney, one of the Marauders. And it becomes apparent that Mooney has a connection with Sirius Black, and they both have a connection with Ron's rat, who is revealed to be the fourth Marauder, Wormtail. Who is the true betrayer of Lily and James Potter.
And James Potter is Prongs.
Trust a rat.
Yeah. And the real evil person. And so they clear Sirius Black's name and sort of, I guess, it's revealed that during the past that the Marauders had a rivalry with Professor Snape, who takes that, who still holds a personal grudge.
He carries that grudge.
And still, he goes out of his way to sort of ruin their plans at that point. What ends up happening is this weird time travel story where Harry and Hermione go back in the past.
Fucking time turner.
That felt like a
necessary. And it becomes Doctor Who.
It felt gratuitous. I love a time travel aspect to these stories, but it just felt like, not forced, but it just seemed like unnecessary as far as it worked within this functionality, but it just seemed like we're throwing that in as well.
The time travel comes in that in the third year, Hermione, being the overachiever, decides she wants to take as many classes as possible.
And in order to do all the stuff she wants to do, she needs the time travel.
It's something that's and the mystery of the book is that how Hermione can take so many classes at once.
Right. Yeah.
And they sort of reveal this time turner, which she had to have special permission to use because it's a dangerous artifact.
Makes you wonder how she even has fun.
Apparently, she doesn't have time for that.
Fun?
What's that?
At the end of the third book, they end up freeing Sirius Black, but they don't clear his name. So he's still on the run. But at the end of this book, Harry's got real family for the first time.
Yeah.
Because they reveal that when Harry was born, Sirius was made his godfather. So he has a link to his family, his old life. Mm-hmm. He has something to hold on to. Mm-hmm.
I wish I had a godfather that cool.
And in the third movie, we get sort of it's directed by Alfonso
Cuarón.
Something.
So he did Children of Men, I think.
Very, very dark.
And his decision with the movies were The movies started to get progressively dark because that's how the stories were. But his vision for the series was significantly darker and a more, I want to say, atmospheric approach to the franchise. That being said, next to the sixth movie, the third movie is my least favorite of the franchise. But I'll let you guys.
It is that. It was that first swerve in that.
The sixth movie is
Half-Life 2.
Yeah. Okay.
The third one is kind of like that swerve. I mean, we were talking about how like, oh, even the font kind of changes at the third one, like where they change from that like. Oh,
I think the third one
to silver.
Yeah.
It's kind of, people kind of split on it.
It actually happens to be my favorite,
but it doesn't. Alfonso took it into a weird direction. Like, one, he was a different director, so he decided to take a completely new set design. So they started adding new areas to Hogwarts that they'd never been seen before.
It was a bit jarring compared to the first two.
And that's understandable when you change directors like that.
Yeah. And then his one of the big things of this book is that Remus Lupin is a werewolf. And the werewolf that they present in the movie does not...
Yeah.
It's not very threatening.
Kind of
weird. It looks like a giant rat more than a giant wolf.
Yeah. It's very homely and skinny.
Yeah, it was kind of
malnourished.
It just seemed like a dog with rabies, and it did a werewolf.
Yeah,
it did. Like that, so.
My favorite part about it, actually, though, is I do like the idea of Harry. He already defeated the Basilisk the year before, which was cool. But I kind of liked how he was learning the Patronus spell and kind of getting connected.
Well, the Patronus is something that was defend against
to defend.
It's something that comes with one of Harry's two signature, I guess, abilities.
Yep.
Theories against him. Another thing I hate about the third movie is that they sort of downplay the Quidditch. What's interesting, which is, I guess, necessary to tell the story they need to do, but the Quidditch... They just like one single Quidditch just to show how Harry gets affected by the Dementors.
Yeah.
In the third book, Quidditch is a big part because that was the first time that the Gryffindor team actually won the Quidditch World Cup.
Yeah.
I mean, not World Cup, the Inter-House Cup. Like, before then, they would always end up losing because something bad would happen to Harry.
Yeah.
But this is the first time that they actually won. It was a big part of the franchise.
And you feel like they just didn't put enough.
I didn't need to see three games.
Well,
they need to see that moment where they win. But
that's understandable.
I know you had a problem with them.
It felt disappointing to me. It's one of the better books. So it was like,
yeah.
Is that like the long? Was it the longest book?
No, it's not the longest book.
Okay, no.
I know. Yeah, I didn't really like Remus's form either. I think my favorite part actually was when they said that the four of them actually, the three of them became Animagus. Animagi. I'm sorry, because of Remus's condition. It's a very simplistic story, but I thought that was cool.
Like his father's friendship with the Marauders and that.
Yeah.
Remus was a sick boy.
He
had special permission to be at the school. And, like, he would always disappear at the full moon, and they got suspicious, and they realized what was happening, and rather than just, like, write him off or let him be alone during that time, they took 5 years of extra study to hang out with their friend at all times.
Yeah, I thought, I don't know, something about it. And then they become grown men later, and they, like, Harry's over to the side, and they're dealing with Wormtail, and it all comes out. And I'm like, they're grown men. I'm like, wow, that's really
deep. It's pretty refreshing to see that long-lasting friendship.
Yeah, that's what
I like. One of the things about how the world and the way the magic works is that friendships you develop in high school, or quote-unquote within school, don't end. The friends you make during school last forever.
It's like a fraternity.
Yeah,
the
relationship thinking that. Just like
you
fraternity.
Make in school last forever.
Really
yeah,
true.
You're right. That's true.
A house is like in the European countries, schools are divided into houses, and people tend to stick with those kind of people for the rest of their life.
Romances that form during that school. Like you're more likely to marry the person you were started dating at school if you're in a serious
relationship.
So
there's a lot of high school sweethearts.
Okay, so that was the fourth movie. And then...
The third movie.
The fourth movie, Goblet of Fire, is sort of...
The international world of wizardry.
It's an exploration of the... the international world of wizardry.
Branching
up to this point, we've been very limited to, I guess, Great Britain and its world of magic.
I guess it would probably answer people's questions, because I know that there were probably people reading and wondering...
Especially
are there other wizards
Americans.
Out there? Yeah.
Yeah, there are other wizard schools out there. And then, like, it opens up with the Quidditch World Cup, which is essentially, I guess, the World Cup for the wizarding world.
Yeah.
And
without
so,
the Vuvuzelas.
Yeah. Well, they have a lot of worse things. Magical things. And so, we meet witches from America, like Belgium. We learn that there's a far bigger Wizarding World than what we see in Britain.
Yeah.
And from there, we get introduced to the Triwizard Tournament when they get back to Hogwarts. And we're introduced to the students from Durmstrang, which I want to say from Bulgaria.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
I just looked that up recently, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Eastern European. And the student from Beauxbatons, which is a French.
Northern Europe, in a way.
Yeah, French, specific French school.
Yeah.
And the Triwizard Tournament being this tournament that used to be held between the three biggest wizarding schools in Europe, but got canceled because of the rampant deaths.
Yeah.
So...
Whoopsie.
But
those goddamn griffins.
In the spirit of magical, brotherhood, they brought it back. And the tournament is that, I guess, three challenges with, between three champions picked by each school. And so the crux of this book is that, rather than being three champions, one for Durmstrang, Beauxbatons, and Hogwarts, there's four.
Yeah.
Because Harry is also picked as the champion.
Yep.
And that, and for him, Harry doesn't immediately go for glory. It always finds him. So for him, it's like, oh, I'll just end up doing it. They tell him you can't just say you're not going to do it.
And I can see how that would piss people off.
Well, yeah.
He doesn't even want it.
The fourth book also continues their sort of testing those barriers of friendship in that Ron gets upset that Harry once again... Well, Ron doesn't
gets
believe...
the shine.
Yeah, Ron doesn't believe that Harry, didn't put his name in the cup. He believes he found some way to do it and is... And angry that Harry didn't help
him.
Because Ron has a superiority complex.
Yeah.
He's got
inferiority complex.
Yeah, inferiority. My bad. He's got four older brothers. No, five. One's a banker. One's a dragon tamer. One's a genius. And the other two.
That's such an odd a banker and then a dragon tamer.
Yeah, he's not like a banker banker, but he's like Indiana Jones type of.
He issues at the Ministry of Magic.
Yeah. Like everyone of his brothers has something significant about them, and then it's just Ron.
Yeah.
So it's just Ron. And then what's even worse is that his best friend is Harry Potter.
Yeah.
So
that'll do things.
Other friends, the brightest wizard
of their age.
That'll do things to yourself, Steve.
That's something else. Once again, foreshadowing.
It's like, it turns into that Office Space Surgery. I could just burn this place down. I could just burn it down.
Another big thing about this series is that this is the first time that they sort of explore romance within the series.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the sixth movie, highlighted that this is where, the teenage hormones would come about.
Yeah.
But it's really in the fourth book where they start exploring some of this stuff. Harry develops a crush on Cho Chang. There's
Everything bad that happens in the
Yoko
world.
Ono of Hogwarts.
Everything that happens bad in the Wizarding World is because of Cho Chang.
Yeah, and then we sort of get the, Hermione, Ron, and Victor Crumb triangle, where they start finally exploring the romance aspect between Hermione and Victor, Ron.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also this minor subplot in the background of who put Harry into the tournament? Who's done this? And for what means are they doing it? Because they early on in this book, they show that Voldemort has somehow recovered from what happened in the first book.
He just won't die.
And is actively seeking to come back to life. And he needs Harry to do it. So there's this sinister shadow throughout the games. Now, next to Order of the Phoenix, this is my favorite book. Because I love sort of the Triwizard Tournament and sort of challenges. Yeah, I love Cedric Diggory, the character, because his entire point of him is he's just a nice guy. There's no flair, he's just a nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's he's not really upset that Harry has become a fellow champion. He's just you're a champion, let's do it together for Hogwarts. It's more for Hogwarts.
Go team, It's D2 the Mighty Ducks.
Yeah. And this is sort of this is one of the first books to sort of mark the maturation of the franchise is that this is the first book that someone actively dies during it.
Yep. And then
Cedric is killed during the final task of the Triwizard Cup.
In front of Harry.
I was really sad about that.
Yeah. It's very I don't want to say random, but sort of...
It just seemed out of nowhere. You don't expect it to go that dark. I did not. I was like, that...
It's worse because he's not killed because he's a threat. He's killed because he's just there.
Yeah. right
wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah, exactly. And I felt like, okay, so where's the magic to bring them back to life? Oh, we didn't. No?
There's no magic.
And then I was like,
which is something I looked up. Which, like, I can understand why they don't do that, but it makes you wonder why there isn't.
There's a point of, yeah.
Something they explored later on, there's been attempts to sort of beat death.
And I just figured this would be the one where it's like, oh, it turns out there was an ancient text or something like that. Like, you expect that kind of thing. So, but then again, Harry came against Ice Fist, so why not? I guess they can bring back the
And then, I'm
sorry.
Yeah, so at the end, the darkness of this book is exemplified by the fact that Lord Voldemort ends up returning to life.
Yep.
By using Harry's blood, resurrecting himself, he gets a new body. And this is the darkest the series gets, and it's such a great book. It's also one of the longer ones. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of time is spent sort of exploring various smaller subplots and sort of showing the Triwizard Cup in full. And then we got the movie.
How'd you feel about it?
I love the fourth movie.
It's a good movie.
It changed the tone from Alfonso's, which was like a dark,
more
atmospheric movie.
This was the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Quite flighty. Yeah, because it was like,
no pun intended.
The Triwizard Cup, like, show all those casts. Like, it was fun.
Yeah,
that's why.
They allowed all the actors to sort of go wild with their.
That
style.
Movie almost makes Prisoner of Azkaban look even weirder in the whole spectrum.
All the characters have long hair.
Yeah, they did. All of them. Yeah.
And we also find out that Cedric Diggory one day becomes Edward Cullen.
Yeah.
he is resurrected as a vampire.
A couple of problems. Like, when we're talking about how they cut things out of the book because, like, budget. Uh-huh. Like, one of the cooler things about the Triwizard Cup is the maze, the last one, which was filled with monsters and, like, traps and all this cool stuff. What we ended up getting is just, like, a dark corridor where the trees tried to kill you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like that would have really pushed their budget, maybe, if they tried to put all those monsters and stuff in it.
But they didn't need to put all of them in there, just a sort of glimpse of what was in there outside this evil tree.
It's just true. They could have maybe put, like, even in, like, in shadow, like, just some monster noises and just foreshadowing evil and danger and whatnot.
I did enjoy at the end when he, just that awe of Harry seeing, I mean, he's seen Voldemort already, but now he, you know, in the movie, of course, you know, rises from the cauldron
in glory.
And he sees him like this little boy.
Friends as
versus
Lord Voldemort was an expired choice.
I still can't believe that's him. I really can't.
Oh yeah.
I really enjoyed that. You know, he didn't say, but it's like, you know, we finally meet moment. Yeah. And they like duel with the.
The movie did a good job of making you really care and feel bad that Cedric died.
He's a character.
Outside of stealing Harry's love interest in the series, he never overtly did anything against Harry.
Nothing
to the point where, like, when all his friends were wearing, like these badges that say support Cedric Diggory, the true champion, Harry Potter sucks.
Yeah.
Cedric was like, I'm kind of sorry about this.
Yeah.
Not my
idea. I mean, and Cedric wasn't really that big of a character, but for him to die and actually have you care, that means they did something right.
And his death has big ramifications for the franchise.
It's
just like,
he's not collateral.
He's
not collateral damage.
It's something that affects Harry deeply.
Well, yeah.
And his dad, like, came. That got me too when his dad came out of the stands. And he's
like,
my boy. I'm like, oh wow.
It's like,
and Harry's like, won't get off of him. It's like, it's okay. It's his father.
A weird artistic choice in that they chose to try to make Cedric seem better than Harry at every turn.
Uh-huh.
Like, remember when they took the port key in the beginning and they all fell out of the sky?
Yeah.
Cedric and his dad and, like, Mr. Weasley are just like floating in mid-air, like tricycles.
Yeah.
And just like, oh.
Like, dag.
And another interesting aspect of the movie is when we talked about Hermione's character early on, we were like, she's supposed to be like this mousy, bushy-haired girl. At the third movie, they changed that.
This is where you start to realize, Emma Watson's kind of hot.
The fourth book was a book where everyone realized that Hermione was a girl.
Yeah.
there's a big scene where she comes down in the books in her beautiful blue dress, and everyone's like, ooh, Hermione's hot.
Yeah.
Hey, girl with the face. Yeah. Oh, my gosh, it's Hermione.
In the movie, she's wearing a pink dress, but the effect is kind of lost when Emma starts dressing more womanly in the third one.
She goes in a tomboyish phase that girls normally around that age go through.
Yeah.
But at that point, she was like 15 years old.
Well, she's also not a giant head of hair at that point in time.
She probably was like 15 or 16 at the time.
16 by then, yeah.
Yeah.
So. But yeah, that's The Goblet of Fire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good book, good movie.
I enjoy that. That's my second favorite movie.
Did a good job of, like, Did you say it was, you said this, that was like one of the longer books, right?
Yeah, one of the longer books.
So for condensing it, I would say like I could tell that there was like
there's a lot of stuff that cut out.
I can kind of feel it. Like I feel like there's something missing.
There are all these nuanced subplots, like
yeah,
all,
maybe,
the turn of the Death Eaters, like Neville's backstory, stuff like that.
Yeah.
All cut.
Neville.
Like,
yeah. That was definitely one of the like better it. Movies right, right. Out of them.
So after that was
Order of the Phoenix. My favorite book of the entire Harry Potter.
And that's actually my last favorite.
I remember you
movie
talking
so
about that back in high school.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Order of the Phoenix is the story of, in the aftermath of Voldemort's return, the Ministry of Magic, the government group who runs the wizarding world in Britain, has refused to acknowledge that Voldemort has returned. They've painted Harry and Dumbledore, who's openly supported Harry's in his act. Dumbledore is one of the few people who, when Harry showed up and said something's wrong, who
I got
always
your
believe
back.
In instincts. Mm-hmm. And so when Harry said that Voldemort was back, Dumbledore was like, okay, he's back, we need to deal with this. When the Ministry refused to do it, Dumbledore brought back his old army from the original Boy Who Lived phase when Voldemort was still in power, the Order of the Phoenix.
Gotta get something done. Do it yourself.
Yeah.
And so we sort of brought into, I guess, not so... The third one, the fourth one was sort of an exploration of the Wizarding World as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
This one was sort of like sort of a Cold War kind of state book.
That's a good, that's a good one.
Yeah,
that's
like
that is.
The Death Eaters are amassing their armies. They're preparing, and in combat, in contrast, Dumbledore has to get his army together and fight back because the Ministry isn't having it.
Yeah.
And to that end, the Ministry is like the Ministry of Magic, and
the
Ministry of Magic is so paranoid that he believes that Dumbledore is secretly using Hogwarts to build an army to defeat, to oppose the Ministry and overthrow it, because he's insecure that like Dumbledore's an amazing wizard, and like they point out many times that he was offered the job of Minister of Magic, but turned it down many times.
Yeah.
And so the current minister is sort of, I guess,
likes to teach.
Well, there's a reason why.
In layman's
terms. But the current minister is like, he's paranoid that Dumbledore could take his job because Dumbledore is much more adept at it. So he installs
just like the government.
Dolores Umbridge as the new Defense of the Dark Arts teacher. Because once again,
this chick,
Hogwarts has gone another year without one.
It may be a testament to her acting.
I would take a Dementor over Dolores Umbridge.
She made it very hard for me. Right. In a good way to watch that movie.
Yeah.
She made it very difficult.
Like, she's one of those who's like annoying. Like,
she's insufferable,
she's
I think.
That's the exact word for her. She reminds me of that religious woman in The Mist that just like, you just hate everything she
she's
does.
The equivalent to me of claws on a chalkboard.
Like that's real. Like
yeah,
I mean, it's like even when she's being like that faux like sanctimonious polite, I'm just like
yeah.
And Dolores Umbridge is eventually she imposes, I want to say, martial law on Hogwarts.
Yeah,
she uses the Ministry's power to take power from Dumbledore.
It turns to Catholic school territory stuff.
And
like
to that end, she doesn't. She becomes, even though she's a defense against the dark arts teacher, she refuses to teach them defense against the dark arts.
She teaches
them
theory,
like a real teacher.
She believes that they're going to use that power to overthrow the Ministry.
Yeah.
And in the fifth year, it's specifically the books, it's really important for Harry and his friends because it's when they take their OWLs, which is sort of like the SA. I want to say the SA. No.
I thought the
HFA or something.
The new
kind of.
Yeah, the HFA of the Wizarding World. It sort of it determines their career path.
Yeah.
It's like their aptitude test, basically.
Okay. There you go.
It's not really their aptitude test. They take another one later.
But it's something similar.
That test you take when you're just like, oh, what did you do when you grew up? Oh, it should be a talk show psychic.
And they make a point that, like,
okay,
she's only teaching them theory. And at the actual test, they actually have to be able to pull all this stuff off.
Yeah.
So Hermione, Harry, and Ron put together the DA, or Dumbledore's Army, which stands for Dark Arts Club, but they turn it to Dumbledore's Army because they're being cute.
Yeah.
And they put together this sort of, I guess, underground club where Harry, being the person who's fought Voldemort and held him off on several occasions, the only person with real experience comes out and teaches the other students like the defensive magic that he's learned in his travels. And
we get a montage scene.
And they go on for this for a long period of time, but the fact that they were doing it ends up getting to the ears of Umbridge.
Of course.
Through betrayals of the group, and Dumbledore is ousted as headmaster of Hogwarts, and Umbridge officially takes over. Another interesting aspect of this book is they took the elements of relationship from the fourth book and carrying on. Harry was infatuated with Cho Chang in the fourth book. And in this book, they actually attempted to date But it didn't work because Cho, who was briefly dating Cedric, who died, is unable to, I guess, reciprocate Harry's feelings in a way that's not crying about her old boyfriend.
I mean, he just died last year. I mean, yeah.
They also introduce... This book is also sort of extends the group of friends that Harry hangs out with on a regular basis. Ginny, who in previous books was sort of pining for Harry in the background, mm-hmm. is a more assertive and independent character now. And Neville, okay. another side character, also becomes
like
a more
him.
Important
yeah.
character.
Yeah.
As well as their introduction of Luna, who also enters their circle of friends. So at the, I guess, climax of the book, when Harry has to go, when Harry's tricked by Voldemort into going into the Ministry to steal a prophecy,
mm-hmm.
Those characters follow. And they sort of become the core, I want to say, cast going on.
Yeah.
The most important
cool.
of
okay.
the students continuing down the story. The fifth book is a turning point of the magical war at this point. And it's continuing sort of how dark the books got.
Yeah.
In that, Cedric Diggory, we were introduced to him in that, well, they made mention of him in previous books, but he was really introduced as a character in that third book, that fourth book where he died.
Yeah.
But a character in Order of the Phoenix, Sirius Black, was introduced in the third one, and we've had a good three books at this point to get to know his character. So his big death hits home really hard for Harry. And the book also ends with the Ministry being forced to recognize that Voldemort is back, because at the end of the book, he tries to confront Dumbledore directly. There's a big wizarding duel.
They have to eat some crow.
And the book, so it ends with like, okay, what was it, the big guy, I want to say, draw of the book was that there was this prophecy that Voldemort needed and wanted. And he went after it, and what we got was what everyone who was reading the books up to this point assumed, that Harry Potter would have to fight and kill Lord Voldemort in the end. Because neither could live while the other survives. So it wasn't anything like groundbreaking, but it sort of,
inevitable.
It was inevitable, but it also gave Harry a certain safety net. In that, by the laws of this prophecy, no one could kill him. Only Voldemort could.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I gotcha.
But so it's one of the things where, like, the Death Eaters at this point were like, you can't kill him. Voldemort has to do it. So they always held back just a bit enough for him to squeak by.
Kind of like the Joker. I have the honor to kill Batman.
Or the fifth movie, directed by David Yates, who would become the permanent director.
Yeah,
for
all
is he the one who did Goblet?
No.
Oh, okay.
He's not a director. But,
Yeah, because I noticed in the last...
Only throw that out because we couldn't remember, but then it's
I know he's doing,
Kieran
I,
Yates.
Because
they're
doing part one and part two for seven.
What's his name?
I know he did like the last three.
The last four.
Well, the
he started with Order of the Phoenix, then Apple of Prince.
Yeah,
he's continuing.
Okay. Yeah, okay, so fair enough. Because I noticed like those all kind of had a fluidity to them, so yeah.
So yeah, Order of the Phoenix, that movie. I significantly remember watching that movie because that was with me, you,
Andrew, and
Troy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we saw that movie together alongside, I think, my sister and your brother. And we had a
good time.
Good times. It was one of my favorite books. And it was, I love to see it translated to screen. There were elements that they took out. Okay, at this point, I think book six had come out. Uh-huh. So the whole Harry-Ginny relationship had been confirmed.
Revealed, yeah.
And so the writers, the director and the writers of the screenplay, all
changed
them,
it up.
They had to make some drastic changes.
Yeah.
To make that relationship organic. So rather than we get this Ginny who's sort of a background, not so much a background character, a foreground character who's independent, has no overt like attention, like romantic tension with Harry, we got a Ginny who was pining for him in the background of like every scene she was in.
Yeah,
which kind of
freaked
me.
I feel like that's a problem with Ginny in the movie, as we said before, is the fact that because of the way they did her in the movies. She just comes off as a creepy stalker.
Kind of, yeah. But my favorite part of Order of the Phoenix actually is all of the training that Harry Potter did with them in that expansion of his friends with Luna, Neville, and.
But, I
really enjoyed
it. I feel like this was probably the movie where they found out how to balance lighthearted feelings and the darkness that's oncoming.
Yeah. It's not my favorite movie.
But it's one of the better
ones.
Yeah.
I also love, because of the characterization, that duel with Dumbledore and Voldemort. I mean, they look like they were actually thinking
that
about
was
the
most dynamic form of wizardry in the entire franchise.
I really enjoyed that.
Another sort of nitpick I have with the fifth movie is that they introduce in the fifth book, they sort of introduce apparating, which was the ability to teleport through magic. And in the movies, characters apparently just showed up in giant clouds of white and darkness. White being the Order of the Phoenix, black being the darkness. And later on, this is just established as this is how people apparate.
Yeah.
But it overtly just looks like people flying.
Yeah, it does.
Which becomes a problem for someone who's read the books, where it's like,
what?
You can't really fly. In magic, you can't fly under your own power.
Yeah.
You need some sort of magical tool. And they just, and it sort of lessens the impact of something that happens later on in the franchise.
Okay. Well, cool. So that's.
Yeah, that's the fifth one.
Nice. My third favorite.
Yeah. Is probably my least favorite of the books for various reasons. Half-Blood Prince is one of the most low-action versions of the of books in the franchise.
There's a lot of exposition going on.
It's just a lot of character stuff going on. We get a more unhinged Draco Malfoy and a more unhinged Harry Potter.
This is
one of the first movies books where like the fact that Harry is usually always right is ignored once again and becomes a problem.
It just seems like, I mean, this was the point during my marathon, I was just like, I was kind of losing it, kind of. I was just like, okay, I've been through this. I kind of know them fairly well. And I'm just like, okay, we've all established that, like, he's always right. Why don't people, like, kind of remember this from the, remember the last time he was wrong? And, yeah, so maybe we should kind of address that. If you weren't a fan before, this was definitely not going to be the one to turn you.
So, yeah, Tabloid Trench was essentially, in the aftermath of the fifth book, Harry has sort of become a celebrity because everyone believes, no one's heard the prophecy outside of Harry and Dumbledore, and Ron and Hermione, because Harry ends up telling them regardless because they're his close friends.
Yep.
But everyone assumes that Harry is the chosen one. And so he goes through another, I guess, round of instant popularity. And this is the book where Harry gets more, I guess, insular about, because he's more popular, people he didn't really interact with start flocking around him, and this becomes more insular in that he starts hanging out with the same group of people now.
Yeah.
Like, he no longer cares about, like, all these other people. He's more upset.
He's almost gotten cliquish.
Yeah, and especially at the death of Sirius, he's more obsessed with sort of just this fight with Voldemort.
It's one of those
things
where if you lose someone close to you, or the people remotely close to you, you kind of cling on to them.
Yeah. And he also, Dumbledore takes an active role in training Harry this time. In the other books, he sort of, like, became this sort of like, I want to say, wayward mentor.
Yeah.
Like, at the end of every book.
Like, I know I'm influencing you, but I'm not directly doing anything.
He would show up at the end of the books and, like, give Harry a sort of a lecture on, like, what happened, what lessons he learned.
Let me tell what you did wrong.
The moral of today's story is.
But this is the first time that Dumbledore actually took Harry under his wing and was like, okay, I need to prepare you for something.
It's like, come here, youngblood.
The main plot is, Harry learning about Voldemort's past. This is where we explore Tom Riddle as a character more. Mm-hmm. Like, his youth, his origins, all that.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's always fun.
And the B-plots would be Draco Malfoy's attempts to kill Dumbledore, and the romantic plot tumor that is Harry suddenly falling in love with Ginny.
plot tumor.
It is a tumor, because number one,
nobody saw it coming. No one saw it coming. Like, it's just, in retrospect, there are hints. But it was one of those things for, like, suddenly to just come out of nowhere.
I mean,
to go from hints and subtleties to, like, oh, it's happening, is just like, oh.
It felt less of, like, an organic, oh, this is the result you should
It was almost like J.K. Rowling was like, at this point, I know everybody's thinking that this is going to be Hermione, but I don't like going the contrary route. So.
Yeah, exactly. She'd
already been started that, like, she, I guess, realized that, like, the Harry Hermione thing became, and around book four, when romance started becoming a bigger part, that's when it became apparent that she was really starting to push Ron and Hermione.
Yeah.
But it was just, like, over time, I've come to accept it. Mm-hmm. I can read it now, but it's just one of those, like, weird, out there moments.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like we were in denial about it. It's just that it felt less organic. It just felt like...
Well, we were in denial.
Well, okay, yeah, fair enough.
There were a lot of shippers out there.
I did not see it coming.
Yeah, it just felt like...
I didn't see it coming.
It felt less...
At that point, I thought, like, she was just, like, she was, like, his little sister.
And at the same time,
just like
creepy.
People thought Hermione was
she's not
Ron's sister.
I didn't get to see the independent-ish...
Not literally.
Weasley, you guys got to. So it may not have been
that
bad.
It just came off like a twist than it did like an actual development in a way for me.
That's how it was weird.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Like,
it's
a twist?
Yeah. Don't make it feel like this was going there the whole time. Not like, oh, it turns out the village is actually in modern days.
Well, I mean, like I said, in retrospect, if you go back and read the old books and you listen to JK's commentary on how the relationship is, like, grew, it makes sense. You can see it coming. But from, like, at that point, I was like, oh.
When you were just reading it, yeah.
And so the main, that was the A plot, B plot, and the more, and, like, the apex of the book, and that Harry, I'm not the apex, another plot is that Harry has got this book, a potions book, that makes him better at potions than Hermione. Now, previously, in the Harry Potter franchise, the only subject that Harry was better at Hermione at was defense against the dark arts.
Right.
Because of the fact that he was more adept at fighting defensive situation, and Hermione is one of those people who knows theory when she knows actual practice.
Yeah.
But with this book and potions, Harry is able to perform perfect potions.
Yep.
Perfect.
Expecto Patron. Yeah.
And he becomes the most, I guess, the most...
Brilliant.
Yeah. Thank you.
He becomes the favorite kid in class. Like, their instructor's in love with him. But the book is sort of...
The teacher's pet has been dethroned.
Yeah. And
long live the genie.
What ends up happening is that Harry starts to confide in this book. Not in the way that genie confided in that diary, but simply because he starts relying on it more and more.
Yeah.
And he starts taking the advice in the book over his own better judgment.
The precious.
So when he tries to confront Draco Malfoy halfway through the book about his extracurricular activities, he uses the spell in the book and nearly kills him.
And that's why you don't listen to books, children.
The book. And at that point... He discards the book completely. He's like, this is evil.
Yeah, see this?
Yeah.
He studies with Dumbledore about Voldemort. We're introduced to the Horcruxes, which become a giant part of the remaining end of the franchises.
Yeah.
And we reveal that some of the Dumbledore has, throughout this book, been attempting to deal with the Horcruxes.
Mm-hmm.
The first one that being discovered is that riddle from that diary from the second book, which is revealed to be a Horcrux.
Okay.
The final... linchpin event of this book is that Dumbledore takes Harry to find a Horcrux, and in doing so, is weakened. And in a weakened state, he is killed by Severus Snape. So, in a quick succession, Harry is lost, Cedric Diggory, Sirius Black,
and now
Albus Dumbledore.
So, pretty much, he's lost kind of someone to look up to, his only family left.
And
then his mentor. So
he might have just killed himself now.
Basically. He kind of didn't leave. He just kind of sort of died.
Yeah.
And to add insult to injury, when Harry attempts to confront Snape, he learns that the person who wrote that potions book that made him so good was Severus Snape, who is the quote-unquote half-blood prince.
Because his mother's was Prince.
His mother's maiden name was Prince.
He was a half-blood.
And he was a half-blood.
So he is the half-blood prince.
Yeah.
Surname.
Not literally,
but I didn't know what that.
The book explores that in the ways like Hermione, because she's upset about the book, goes out of her way to investigate who this half-blood prince is. Like, there's no princes in the Wizarding World, and no one would be like bragging about being a half-blood. So she was adamant to, I guess.
But that was mostly fueled by no one's better than me.
Yeah.
And Severus had just simply
hidden
the book when he was a kid. Simply, graduated.
Yeah, he just abandoned it because he didn't need it anymore.
Yeah, whatever. Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
So, half-blood prince movie, still directed by David Gates, and
in
part one,
incredibly dark.
It's very. It takes a lot of the atmosphere that Alfonso put into that third one and brings it back for this one.
And this time, it actually works.
It works.
I think
but it's
so.
Still, my least favorite movie.
I really thought that thing, not in a bad way, pushed the boundaries of PG. I was surprised out of my mind. I was like, just thematically,
yeah,
that should have
been
PG.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That
just
been
thematically,
PG,
it
should have been PG.
It did kind of feel like Indiana Jones, or like, because it was like the first movie to get, like, one of those first ones to get
really.
Well,
the reason I
feel
this
you feel the darkness that it was like, you feel the darkness that it was like, wow, you're kind of pushing boundaries of like, what's acceptable for these, kids, mostly.
No,
one of the parts I hate, one of the parts that maybe pissed me off about this movie is the way they marketed it. Was like, this was the first time in the franchise that they were going to explore emotion and romance and all that, and teenage romance coming out.
Huh.
But, like, for some reason, the books and, like, watch the other movies, like, they've been exploring that since book four.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is nothing new.
Yeah, so it was, like, delayed gratification almost.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I see what you're, I see where you're going with that, but, like...
It's also, because it's, as a book, it wasn't the most exciting.
Yeah.
To the point where they added a completely superfluous sequence in the middle of the movie where the Death Eaters attack Ron's house.
Wasn't needed.
Wasn't needed, and it sort of flubs up the last book in, like, I guess, in continuity.
So, so you feel like it would have been a better movie if it was more exploratory?
Kind of, but I knew that wouldn't fly. They would have needed
big action. They needed a big action set piece for, like,
those. I will say, though, that scene when Dumbledore died was painful.
Yeah, that really...
Like,
well,
that
never mind.
Was,
you
that
talk.
Was,
everyone
yeah,
knows.
My, the only saving grace in this movie for me is that David Yates, and what I love about him as a director, is that of the franchise, is that he knows how to balance those comedic moments. Mm-hmm. So while it is a dark film, there's still bits of levity that just make me crack up.
You know, you're all right. Because, like, I will grant that, like, he does play it in a way that's just like, it's not like people die and someone's cracking a pun or something like that. No, it actually does. It does feel like these moments of levity are just in a way to kind of deal with, like, their own, it's not like this weird, it's not like Michael Bay, where it's like...
No, like,
that
it's
should be,
so
yeah.
much, like, just comedic beats just to, like,
exactly.
move the movie.
That's
right,
more
right.
to like, the credit, I feel like that's more to the credit of, like I said about the last film, how he's figured out a way to balance light and dark, but also the chemistry
between the actors, that sort of scene where, like, Harry and Hermione are in the library.
Uh-huh.
And, like... Like, the Romilda Vane character is sort of staring at him, and he's like, you know, she's only interested in you because you're the chosen one. He's like, but I am the chosen one. And then she beats him with a book. It's funny to see moments like that litter through it. And then, like, that from a fan standpoint, I'm like, okay, it kept me engaged even though the movie bored me to hell.
If it didn't have those moments,
it was the only one I didn't see in theaters.
If it didn't have those moments, it probably would have been the darkest movie.
I really felt for Dumbledore in the cave thing. That kind of got me.
Yeah,
I was like,
wow. It's a lot darker if you understand the context of why he was in such pain. And then another aspect that sort of annoyed me is something, this actually about the movie in the whole, is that in the books, there's sort of a vague understanding of how many students are at Hogwarts.
Uh-huh.
In the movies, however, they just play loose and fast with what student is in what year and what... Like, that Romilda Vane girl, she's a year younger than Harry in the books. So she wouldn't be in his class. And the Katie Bell girl who was attacked by the cursed necklace, she's like a year older than Harry. So she wouldn't be in his year. But when they go to that potion class, everyone's in the same class.
Yeah, that is a bit strange.
There's that random moment with that black kid
in the third movie.
We're like, what's with these random?
Like, let's just for.
Well, it's almost like it's
Michael
almost like
Bay.
It's almost like they forgot.
I think they were just trying to.
Oh hey,
they were just trying to pad the cast.
I think that's what it felt. That's what it felt like.
They were trying to pad the cast. Like they didn't. Like they were like, I guess in Harry's year, there are five boys, I think three or four girls, and like they usually in the books like two classes, the two houses of the same year will always be in the class. So at the end of the day, that would be about maybe 18 kids. Like, and they didn't. And they felt that, I guess from a filmmaking standpoint, that was enough kids to really show a classroom.
Yeah.
So they just started shoving other kids in.
This is throwing. It's like on TV, a classroom will be like 9 kids, and that doesn't make sense. That won't fly in a movie. But here it's just like we just need to fill it out. But it shouldn't in Wizarding School maybe like be a little more intimate.
That's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
Because the last book is coming out. I mean, the last movie is coming out. We won't be discussing that last book here. Off camera, we can talk about this book as much as you want.
Yeah.
But for now, we can't because it's kind of like...
No, yeah.
The book has been out since 2007, So you had more than enough
time to read it.
But
for the sake of spoilers,
yes, those who see the movies, yeah. And I've only seen the movies.
And since this is coming out before the movie,
yeah.
You know, it would be unfair for you to listen to this, for those that listen, and then watch it and not really get the experience that you should get from it.
Odds are when we talk, when we review that final movie,
we'll go into
that book.
Cool, okay.
So there'll be a slight part two to this podcast during your normal weekly dose.
Yeah.
Nice.
But to talk about the movies as a whole, I've had this conversation off mic before in that the movie as a whole, for me, the Harry Potter fan who's read the books,
okay,
have been good to okay. They haven't reached a certain level. Like it's normal. It's normal to say like, oh, it's never be more. This franchise will never be better than the books.
Yeah, that's quite normal. It's normal saying, really.
But this is one of the few times when I've read the books and I've watched the movies. And I'm like, okay, this isn't as good as the books because of that. What I've said earlier before about like they had no end goal in sight.
Mm-hmm.
The changes of director, the changes of tone.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that they. When you change directors, you automatically get different visions, which Jovi said before. And unfortunately, that jars things and messes up.
I feel like compare this to Lord of the Rings in that Lord of the Rings are a great series of books.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But they are nearly painful for the uninitiated to get through and just read.
Right.
Because there's a lot of words and there's a lot of just walking around in a little
especially, yeah. Yeah, especially if you don't know what type of story you're actually reading.
And the movies, and it can be said that the movies are better than the books in that they took what can be a great series and made it less dense, and exciting for normal people to see.
Except for the first one.
Yeah. Because they took themes.
The first one was a bit hard to get through, but once you get through the first
the main
one, the second
characters
two.
And main whatever. From Fellowship to Return.
These are 3-hour journeys that, which by all means,
they distilled all the major plots from the book, kept everything, put them in a movie, long movies, and kept everything.
Yeah.
Harry Potter, they sort of had to pick and choose, and in doing so, have cut the continuity of the franchise.
And I feel, I feel like looking back, and also looking at like, because the other day I was looking at highest grossing films ever, just randomly, and. The as long as the Lord of the Rings books were, they made boatloads of money, which makes me believe that the Harry Potter books could have got away with putting more in it, and it was still made a lot of money.
You know what? I think that's
the early problem is that because of the way the tone of the books had been, those early books had to be something that a child could watch.
Oh yeah,
digest.
Well, like I can understand the first couple and why they're a bit light. On you know content sometimes that's understandable, but as they got you know more dark and as people grew up, I feel like you know and as people's attention spans grew, I feel like they could have got away with putting more in there and made it more dense and would have still been as successful. But you know
past. Yeah, but you know, and a lot has to do with the fact that Tolkien's books had been done for a long time before those movies got made.
Indeed.
But the Harry Potter books, they were a cash grab in a sense. A good one. I won't say none of them were. I mean, from what I've seen, like I don't think any of them were overtly bad.
No,
personal. Like that's my personal opinion. Of course, I'm not the
one. None of those books are bad by any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, and
there are some problems. Like
I mean,
as much as I really like the last book, there are a lot of subtle problems with it.
Yeah,
you mean movie or book?
Book.
Oh. Yeah, we still haven't seen. And from what I'm saying, it's like none of them are overtly bad. They've been faithful. Mostly.
To a certain extent.
I mean, based on what I've read on forums and all the, and like, you know, diehards of the sort. I guess it's just a matter of like, when you're going through different directors and you're making movies at the same time the books are coming out, you're going to have this issue. You can't streamline it like the way they did with the way Peter Jackson did with the Tolkien books.
Right. What I will say about the films though is I will forever have respect for the three main characters. But just because, you know, sticking with it, like, you know, I mean,
it's one of the things where I respect them deeply, but I sort of feel bad with them at the same time. Children actors, especially children actors who sort of grow into roles, will never be able to escape them.
Yeah,
so that's like, another reason why I add a layer of respect to
them. So, the recent controversy with Emma Watson in that she was unable to complete college, something that she professed and wanted to do since she started on this franchise because she will be forever known as Hermione Granger.
And, you know. But at the same time, you know, they were so good at being these characters with what they were given. You know, I feel like there wasn't one bad casting, actually. Like, no, I feel like everybody...
I've had some problems with some of the acting every once in a while, specifically with Emma Watson. I think she sort of overacts, and Hermione puts a bit too much emotion into everything that she does.
Yeah.
Outside of that...
Not Shia LaBeouf territory, but yeah.
Yeah, and like, I feel like it's like the people, when they cast this movie, really sat down and thought about who this character is.
Yeah.
And just pick the best of the best they could get.
Yeah, they're at least serviceable.
And it's one of the few movies where everybody that gets cast is
fantastic.
Yeah.
Because it's cool. Like, there's no, outside Jason Statham, there's no, like, bad, like big-name British actors. Like, in America, we have, like, hundreds of, like...
We've got a few gems... Some that are really good, some that are okay, and then just a lot of bad ones.
Yeah.
In Britain, they've got like there may be. I'm not engrossed in that sort of British film community. But for the most part, all the characters, all the actors they casted are sort of big named
Shakespearean theatrical actors.
Well, Europe tends to have more classically trained and overall better actors, more well-rounded actors.
We didn't have movie stars.
Yeah.
It's funny because like when the early parts of the book, like the early fears that like the production team who were British had were that if Hollywood got their hands on this book, would they try to make it American?
Yeah.
And this is what I thank J.K. Rowling for. She was like, "That's not going to happen."
That's another thing.
She had a very active hand in the control of these franchises.
Yeah. And that's what they should do for more adaptions, because it's rare. It's rare to see movie adaptions from books that actually keep an international cast.
We talk about whitewashing, and this is like just like American watching, and which was like something that people were fearing. I mean, it just would have been a completely different tale.
There were a couple American actors slipped in there, here and there, but never in big enough roles where it'd be important.
Like,
Chris Columbus's daughter was one of the actors in the first two movies.
I'm like, mad, you know?
She was a named character, but she wasn't a big role.
Yeah, and they never it's never a big American actor, so it never drowns out.
You never really pick up. I was like, oh, that one kid. It's like, this is why I loved it when they got
all the reason. Apparently, it's Trevor's name.
Whoa. That'd be so weird.
I don't like any of it. Well,
turn to page 394. I know Kung Fu. Whoa.
We've talked a long time about this episode.
Well, Terry it's Potter. Probably pretty long.
If you wanted to hear us talk more about Harry Potter, I mean...
See us in the streets.
Well, what did you... My favorite part of this entire story... actually is the relationships and the growing up. What do you guys take away from Harry Potter, just in general?
It's the craft. It's like going back and reading the books from the beginning and like seeing the little things that will show up toward the end and the imagination. That like I love, I talked about this earlier in the podcast, that I feel like at the end of the series hated the three main characters because they were so layered and so realistic. But it's one of those things where like the craft and the franchise and all the little things that people in the movies really didn't get to see because the story got cut out, so they weren't part. But as someone who read all the books multiple times in order and through, like, I read one, okay, I'm going to read seven, I'm going to read three, and stuff like that. Like, you just see the little parts pulled together and just build a tree of, like, what the important aspect is. Like, just the craft of the series. That's what I
really appreciate you saying that, because the way the relationships between the main three and the additional characters after like,
the main three, the relationship is pretty much... cemented towards the end of the book.
I just enjoy that, you know, who can I trust? My godfather died. I'm dealing with grief. I'm dealing with what do I want to be?
As much as
discovering yourself.
Like, it sort of becomes World War II, like the world is against Harry. He refuses to give up on some of his more admirable traits.
Tenacity.
No matter what, he always stays true to himself.
Is that
what do you take away from it, Joe?
Yeah, when you think Harry Potter, having read it and watched it, what do you just love hands down?
The fact that matter how rotten things can get, he always still remains his true to himself. I find it admirable in the fact that, God, like, I mean, I gave him my final leg, but, I mean, it has to get better somehow. Mm. It's almost this weird sense of blind optimism. It's just that...
I also sort of take from the fact that Harry... inherently such a good person.
He doesn't. He stays true to himself.
That, yeah. Is that childhood innocence that he had? Was like it never quite goes away. I guess like
yeah. You know,
it gets rough. Things get harder. It always looks like he loses sight of it, but he never does.
Yeah, it's like he doesn't turn naive, but it's like you can still. It's still there, kind of.
Like he's the most important figure in modern wizarding history.
Nothing that special about
and
him.
And it's never phased him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like. Cool.
If you really like take away all the fame and everything, he's just
a normal guy.
He's a normal, it's just yeah. your average Joe, or whatever that is from Britain.
Yeah. Average chap.
An average bloke.
Yeah. I mean, guys. As somebody that hasn't read any of the books,
which you should,
but has watched all the movies, but has heard people outwardly talk about the book, including Avery, I can say that this, like I said earlier, this is a modern classic. And to me, that's refreshing nowadays.
The biggest problem with Harry Potter is that no one has been able to replicate the success of a serialized franchise.
Oh, yeah, no.
And
no.
many people have tried to
and, bury and that, the next. That is going to hurt, you know, Hollywood
for a
because
long time.
Not only storytelling, but, you know, Hollywood's looking for this new franchise to blow up. And unfortunately, that's not going to happen because not only is, like, you know, there's Twilight out there. But like that's but that's popular, not necessarily good. And Harry
I
Potter.
I like that differentiation.
Yeah, and
it
Harry
funny,
Potter.
You can call it bad. You can say
it. It's funny that like Twilight there's this massive backlash towards it because people understand it's bad. With Harry Potter, the backlash comes from crazy fundamentalists and sort of an older generation who's seen this
old
come and go.
Yeah. But Harry Potter is the right mix of popular and good. And that's rare. Like, that doesn't happen
often. Lightning in the bottle.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those once
no pun intended.
Every...
No, okay, no, we intended.
Decade
yeah.
or
like,
whatnot.
Yeah, the Lord of the Rings were, like, a great series of books.
Yeah.
And they were popular.
Fantasy, nerd. It wasn't
but they
were bigger than that.
They weren't public knowledge.
I yeah.
mean, even before the Harry Potter movies were made, everyone knew
it. But you'll see, like, I remember when we went to see Deathly Hallows Part 1. And you'll see a varied crowd of people in that theater. You wouldn't really see that for a Lord of the Rings movie. You get a certain group of people in there. But for Harry Potter, people know what Harry Potter is.
Harry's so accessible, whereas Tolkien was an academic.
Yeah.
I think that might
this
maybe
is, these
play
are
into
dense
it.
Reads.
Those are I mean, he's right. That's why I said earlier, many people don't know what they're getting into. It's a, how do you pronounce it? Legendarium? It's a mythology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's written as a mythology. Lord
but
of the Rings,
this
Harry,
but
like,
Harry
this
Potter.
Is
that's
Harry
fantasy,
Potter is a
kids
Harry
reading.
Potter is a phenomenon, and we don't have many of those.
It's easy to pick up.
Yeah.
That's why for me, reading that last book was painful.
I can imagine because whenever we get around to seeing the next movie, it'll be painful for me.
Me too. Yeah.
You know, I might tear up a bit just because it's the end of an era.
Yeah.
And that's always hard to witness.
Yeah. And. What did you?
I'll probably say about Hermione's hiney. I don't know. But no, I honestly, the atmosphere more than anything, just like creating a world, just seems so like.
That's my favorite part of storytelling.
Yeah,
creating a world that can exist even without your main character.
It's just something about like you know you read and like watch movies so you can escape into this fantasy land, and it's just like yeah, there are these characters there, but it's like you always kind of want to meet and interact with them, sure, but it's like I just want to be a part of it and like kind of live amongst them or whatever
yeah.
or have you. And they managed to really establish that. There's always stuff flying around in the background. There's things like, and people are just like, oh, la-di-da-di-da. Hey, it's a candle with legs. All right, it's fine. And it's just things like that.
The sense of wonder. Like,
yeah.
For the magical people, this is mundane. But for someone reading in this world, it's like, I want to go back to
talking
dogs.
It's like, I wish I was satiated with these kind of things.
I wish it was real.
Yeah. I dig this kind of stuff.
Kind of the same way I felt about Pokemon when, you know, It just came
out. Pokemon is a lot of like minutiae of like economy and stuff that.
Yeah, but like you're
not explaining to like.
No, but I wish
like,
it was real.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And
I wish my mom let me travel the world alone when I was 10 years old.
I mean, and another thing, real quick that I think that is really cool about Harry Potter is it's named after the main character, and the main character never ever feels unimportant.
Yes.
Like, there are you know, a lot of movies and stories where they're not named after the main character, and it's kind of like, you're important, but you're not as important as we thought at first. But Harry Potter
is... The story
is
more important than you.
Exactly. But Harry Potter is never... Like, the story never goes above Harry Potter. Like, there's a bigger story out there, but Harry is always in the center.
He's always in the center.
Yeah. And that's why it's named after him. And like,
every time someone tries to remove him from that center, he always ends up being pulled back in.
Exactly.
And he does seem to matter. Whereas, like, you know how a lot of people felt, we keep comparing it to
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, but you know how a lot of people, I happen to have felt this way sometimes, a lot of people like Sam better than Frodo.
Yeah.
Sometimes because he, like, did stuff and Frodo is always whatever.
And Frodo was kind of crazy throughout the entire franchise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With Harry, at least near as I could tell, you couldn't really do that.
Well, also
you liked Hermione and Ron, and they brought whatever they brought. Well, they were themselves. And
also, with Lord of the Rings, there were several main characters, and they kind of switched between movies. Like Frodo was more of the main character in one movie, and then it became Aragorn.
Yeah.
Whereas Harry has these other characters, but it's always Harry.
But then that's your point. Just like you're right. I didn't see it, but yeah, it's all about. Right. Aaron, he stays center stage. That's pretty good.
Yeah, okay.
Aragorn is great.
Yeah, it's...
That's all right.
If this is pushing like 3 hours... So.
I mean, it's our longest episode in a while, but when you have a franchise like this, like we said, it's a phenomenon, you kind of have to talk.
Yeah.
I'm not sorry. This has been good.
Yeah. So yeah, this has been our Harry Potter episode. Phil, plug the show.
Okay, I got it. You've got the Tumblr, which is pcploversanonymous.tumblr.com, which is directly connected to the iTunes. Just look for the link, click on it, and search for Chagall or Pop Culture Podcast and subscribe. Then we've got the Facebook. Wait, I should have said the email first. But whatever. We got the Facebook, which is Pop Culture Podcast. Search for that and then like us. Then we got the email, which is welovepcp@yahoo.com. Give us feedback, suggestions, whatever. And then we have the Twitter, which is WeLovePCP.
Yeah, okay, that's cool. This has been. I normally would plug the next 5 episodes in advance, but quite honestly, we didn't do this episode with a general script, so I don't have that readily offhand. What I can tell you is the next episode, 037, will be our Captain America episode.
And that's all we know for now, America. But we'll be back on track soon.
Yes.
What track?
Whatever.
Hogwarts Express.
Yeah.
That's the track.
Indeed.
I was setting you up for that.
No, you weren't.
Liar!
So yeah, I'm Ian Williams, signing off for the rest of the boys who are on this Harry Potter episode.
You've got our nicknames, didn't you?
No, I still remember them. I just don't use them. I'm tired.
I understand. It's Marcus Ellison, Gryffindor House.
How'd that work? Cool, he's Ravenclaw House.
Josiah Bradley, but I don't remember my house.
You were Hufflepuff.
You were Hufflepuff, and you were Slytherin.
I was Hufflepuff.
Chagall was Ravenclaw.
Yes.
I was the only one that remembered my house. Because I'm brave.
I guess I was eating too much chicken.
Yeah.
Yes, you were, Josiah.
Josiah's so fat.
The grease got to your brain.
He wants Slim Jim.
Look, there's a lot more Harry Potter we can discuss. We can dissect everything minutia. We could probably put in another 2 hours this.
Yeah.
But we're tired. We didn't realize how much we were going to be talking. And we're signing off now. However, if you do want more Harry Potter, want more talking, us talking about it, I would love to do a special episode and just wrap everything up. Just let us know.
Or you can listen to the Weekly Dose when we see the movie.
Yeah, because that's either or. Be very you can long have as well.
I don't want this to end.
We know, Avery. We know.
No one wants it to end. No more Harry Potter after this.
But, you know.
Way to make it end on a down note, dude. Jeez.
Cue Boys to Men, end of the road, as we walk out the room.
Yeah.
Magic may fail you, but friends won't.
I'll see you.